Dr. Peck, thank you so much. It's not very often that in public health that the President of the United States spends time on your recommendation, so it was great to hear about it. Thank you. Next, we have an economist. Don't leave the room. Okay? I've known him for 15 years. I've worked with him for a long time. He's the smartest guy I know. Dr. Michael Matusik is a health economist and senior research investigator at the Health Partners Research Foundation right here in Minneapolis. His team systematically evaluates the health impact and cost effectiveness of preventive services. And I can tell you, nobody knows more about the relative value of preventive services, which make the biggest impact on population health, which provide the biggest bang for the buck, than Mike. And I know some of you may be a little wary about cost effectiveness and how it gets used in policy, but I can promise you that one of your biggest advocates in public health is right here in Mike Matusik. So thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Ashley. Wow, that's going to be an easy act to follow. Now I know what it takes both to keep an audience awake after lunch and to be the founding dean of School of Public Health. As Ashley introduced, I've been working quite a while on the relative value of clinical preventive services with Ashley for much of that time. And today I want to put some of the new STD screening, new to us, STD screening recommendations into perspective of the real value of services. This has been, the background study has been ongoing for several years. It's a collaboration of Health Partners Research Foundation with Partnership for Prevention in Washington, D.C. And I just want to gratefully acknowledge on the outset our funders over the years. CDC in particular has been the major funder, and supplemented by the Robert Johnson Foundation and the WellPoint Foundation. To motivate a little bit, I want to put in perspective the time that clinicians are spending on prevention and how much time they really need. One study, these are case reports, they're not necessarily representative, but the difference between the two will tell you how big of a gap there is, showed that 11% of physician time in one clinic setting was spent on 60 preventive services, amounting to 7 minutes per patient per year. Now, maybe if you limit it to evidence-based services, then maybe that's not so bad. Or maybe it is. Another study estimated what it would take in a typical patient panel of 2,500 patients to deliver just the A and B services recommended by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. It would take 86% of physician time and 42 minutes per year. Per patient per year. What was the last slide? 11% and 7 minutes? Big gap between what is, no matter how representative that one setting is, between what is being done and what is needed. So the competition for clinician time, even amongst the preventive services themselves, is very stiff. And then when you add into it all the treatment that they're doing on a daily basis and the stuff that a lot of people are coming in to see their physician for, it gets a challenge to get everything done. With that in mind, Partnership for Prevention put together the National Commission on Prevention Priorities to try and help sort out where initial efforts really should be focused. Coverage is going to take away a big barrier here, but it's not going to solve everything. You still need clinicians to deliver the care, you still need motivated clinicians to deliver the care, and you need health systems that support what clinicians want to do. So in order to help clinicians and health systems decide where to focus their quality improvement efforts, this panel, representing stakeholders from across the healthcare system and public health, came up with a set of methods to help us decide where to focus efforts. The scope of the study is the U.S. Preventive Services recommended for the general population. We've added recently those at higher risk for cardiovascular disease and those at higher risk for STDs. It also includes the ACIP recommendations for the general population. I'm not going to get deep into methods, but I want to give you a sense of where this is coming from. The Commission prioritizes services on two measures of value: clinical preventive burden, or probably more easily, health impact. What, what's the health impact of the services, which we measure in years of life adjusted for qualities, so we can standardize across services, and cost effectiveness, the standard measure of economic value, which allows for services not just to be cost savings, but to provide good value for the money invested, even if they're not cost saving. In this update, we're including services now for individuals at high risk for STDs. And to do that, we introduced some new methods. I'm going to go through those briefly, sort of the first layer of the onion. We did this for several reasons. One is to introduce disease transmission in the estimates. We previously estimated screening for chlamydia, but had not had disease transmission in the model. We also wanted to answer a couple of questions, such as is screening important to interrupting disease transmission, and does reinfection limit the effectiveness of screening? We also wanted to explore the impact on population groups. In the past, we've looked just at the general population, what's the relative priority, but we want to see what we could learn about the importance of preventive services for population groups in case there are services that seems are not that important at the population level, but for some populations are very important. And finally, we wanted to build a unifying framework for all of these STDs so that we could compare them in one model, make sure that we had consistency. Three services we're going to talk about today are the screening services recommended by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. You're probably quite familiar with these: chlamydia screening for all sexually active women, gonorrhea screening for sexually active women at increased risk, and syphilis, the only one of the three screening services that includes men. To analyze these, we've built an agent-based model, and I want to call up my colleague Ajay Bell, who did all the heavy lifting on this model. In short, an agent-based model is a representation of a social network, and in this case, a sexual network. So allowing people to simulated individuals to interact in the model and to transmit disease. And maybe a little bit more background about what's in the model. Well, let's say that. The important part of this is transmission, because individuals in an agent-based model take actions. They interact with each other, which they cannot do in a standard model, and as a result of those interactions, infections occur. And this is what happens in the real world, and so it makes perfect sense to address an agent-based model. Agent attributes. The model starts off by randomly assigning attributes to simulated individuals based on the U.S. population distribution. So their age, their gender, race, ethnicity, sexual preference, socioeconomic status, and then two other pieces that sort of come out of the model: their location in the geographic space and core membership. Are they or are they not part of the endemic core? The endemic core is defined primarily in two ways: by their behavior. Do they have high risk behaviors that makes them part of the endemic core? And is their location on the grid, regardless of location, behavior, make them more susceptible to transmission? The model starts with initialization, and then it runs. So we give people these characteristics, and it goes cycle by cycle, week by week in this case. People move across the grid according to their preferences, find partners according to their preferences, create sexual relationships, and transmission happens. The disease etiology itself defines the differences between the STDs and their prevalence. It's fascinating where everything else in the model is the same, but how symptomatic, what percentage of cases are symptomatic, how long they're symptomatic, the probability of disease detection, all determined the differences that we observe in the population, the prevalence among these three diseases, chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis. The results, in brief, you might want to focus just on the last column for chlamydia screening, show that there is indeed a reduction in chlamydia cases. That is, screening does, according to our model, reduce transmission. It does reduce PID, improves health, measured as reduction in qualities lost, and it's cost effective. Our current estimate right now is $16,000 per quality. This is comparing 85% screening to 0% screening. In the Prevention Priorities Project as a whole, we look at what happens if clinicians were to offer the services to all population, but we don't assume that everybody accepts it. So we're starting with a presumed acceptance of 85%. For gonorrhea screening, not too surprisingly, much the same because of the similar nature of the sequela. It does present cases, reduces PID, and subsequently similar percentage reduction in health measures qualities lost, and is also cost-effective, but not quite as cost-effective. It's a more targeted recommendation, so that it helps the cost-effectiveness, but it's a much lower prevalence rate, so it's a little bit more difficult. For syphilis screening, much more effective. It's a very targeted recommendation to the highest risk populations, highest risk of prevention, so lower cost intervention overall. The cost effectiveness is much improved, even though the population health impact isn't as great. Summarizing the two measures that the NCPP uses to rank the value of services, then in one slide, same numbers, you can get a sense of the relative difference among the three. With chlamydia screening, the most prevalent of the conditions having the highest population-wide impact, and syphilis screening being the most cost-effective. To create a ranking, the NCP takes these two measures, health impact and cost-effectiveness, takes all the clinical preventive services recommended by the task force for the general population, sorts them by each measure, and gives them a score based on quintile 1 through 5, 5 being the best. So 5 being the highest health, 5 being the highest health impact, and 5 being the highest cost effectiveness. The result of that is simply a ranking based on total score, adding those two together. This is our 2006 ranking, in which I am inserting our new estimates for the STD screening services. None of the STD screening services rise to the first 8 or 9 services on the list. And chlamydia screening and syphilis rise to the next page. Now, I want to say that these are old rankings, which we are finishing up now, and there's a lot of changes above these services, and I know that chlamydia screening, well, okay, I won't say it with absolute certainty, but I'm very confident that chlamydia screening will rise up to its usual top in the top half of the ranking, our new ranking, when we make the adjustments to the other services. A lot of changes there. Syphilis screening being very cost-effective also rises up to probably near the top half of the middle third of the ranking. And gonorrhea screening, due to the relatively low population health impact and lower but still reasonable cost effectiveness, falls towards the bottom. It's important in these rankings, but well, I'll do it in summary. So what we are concluding is that, as you know, STD screening is effective in reducing transmission and reducing PID and late-stage syphilis. STD screening is cost-effective. All of these are below $50,000 per quality. They're all worth doing. And targeting helps, making some of them more cost-effective than they otherwise would be. What you're seeing is that syphilis and gonorrhea screening may not rise to the top of population-wide rankings, but you have to think about what else is on that list, right? Screening for chronic conditions. Childhood vaccinations, osteoporosis screening, adult immunizations for those over age 65, influenza pneumococcal vaccinations. So when you look at just the services for the population that's really at highest risk for STDs, there's very little that rises above the STD screening services. Tobacco cessation counseling is one. And in these ages, you know, although some of the other services cover this age range, such as maybe some of the hypertension screening, and at the older ages, the cholesterol screening, and breast cancer screening, maybe for some age groups. But overall, the risk at those younger ages in those services is much smaller, and on an age-specific basis, these services are still very important to those populations. So as we look forward to what happens in healthcare reform, there is, I think, very real reason to be vigilant about what happens to these services. There's worry about what's going to happen to STD clinics. Is this care going to go to primary care? How good of a job is primary care going to do? And if primary care is thinking about their broad population, and they're, as they're developing clinic systems, are they going to lose sight of these services that are still very highly important to those who are at risk? So although there's going to be first dollar coverage for the vast majority of the population, that's not going to solve everything among busy clinicians and busy healthcare systems, and it's going to pay to stay vigilant. Thank you.